This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 300 years ago today, Benjamin Franklin was born in Boston, but colonial Boston was much too conservative to hold young Ben. Barely out of short pants, he was out in the world, inventing Poor Richard's Almanac and lightning rods, inventing lending libraries and allies in revolution, inventing the odometer and bifocals, and a nation, a national character, a republic, he quipped, if you can keep it. Ben Franklin lived large and long. He was founder and rascal, a fierce enemy of tyranny and a radical egalitarian. That twinkle in his eye still speaks to us today. Up next on Point, what it says. Benjamin Franklin at 300. You've got some great guests to talk with about Franklin today. First, joining me from New Haven, Connecticut, is Edmund Morgan, Professor Emeritus of History at Yale. He is author of the biography Benjamin Franklin and has for 15 years overseen the Benjamin Franklin Papers at Yale, the most extensive collection of materials by, about, and around Franklin and his times in a single collection. Edmund Morgan, welcome. Thanks for being with us today.
Greetings. Glad to be here.
And with me in the studio is Philip Dre, author of Stealing God's Thunder, Benjamin Franklin's Lightning Rod, and the Invention of America. He's also author of At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America, finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2003. Philip Dre, wonderful to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be here.
We're going to hear later in this hour from Stacy Schiff, who's also written about Franklin and in particular about his time in France as a key American diplomat in the Revolutionary Era. Edmund Morgan, as we celebrate Ben Franklin's 300th, I understand it's your 90th today, so happy birthday to you as well, sir.
Thank you. Franklin is a little older than I am.
Just a little. And not only older than you, he was older than nearly all of his famous compatriots in the founding of this country.
Absolutely right. And in many ways, the youngest of them in his ideas and general outlook on society.
Edmund Morgan, you followed how Americans think about, talk about, see Benjamin Franklin for a long time. Here we are on his 300th birthday. What's the image of this man that you think has settled into the popular consciousness? And in your view, as a historian, how does it square with the facts?
Well, he's seen always as a pragmatist and always as a sort of homespun, crackerbox philosopher, writing little adages about being industrious and thrifty and so on. And that is not really a very close picture of what he was really like. Yes, he believed in industry and thrift. He retired, I think was about the age of 42.
From publishing?
From business. Mm-hmm. From his publishing business. And he was not only the oldest of the founding fathers, but he didn't agree with them on a great many things. For example, they thought the revolution was a war, a fight about the natural rights of men to property. And Franklin helped them, went along with them on that, but did not himself believe that property was a natural right. He believed that it was the creature of society and that society had the right to take it away from any individual or group of individuals for social purposes.
In fact, I read he was such an egalitarian that at one point he proposed limits on wealth in the United States of America, if I got that right.
It's probable that he did. There was a clause to that effect in the first draft of the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776. It did not survive, but he did often say that property was a creature of society, and he worried about the fact that Americans were not willing to pay for their revolution as they went along, that they wanted to borrow money, and made him the man to borrow it. But he thought that Americans should have fought the revolution on their own. Instead, they sent him to France to borrow money.
He brought money, and he brought in an ally that was key to the success of that revolution, ultimately. Philip Dre, join us here. We're going to look a lot at Ben Franklin's politics and philosophical outlook, but he was also just a straight-up innovator on an amazing number of fronts, introducing lending libraries and fire companies, police force, hospital, university, insurance companies, sanitation departments, the idea of militia. You have looked in depth at his scientific contributions, and lest we lose him in a cloud of diplomacy and romance, remind us of just what a scientist he was, how he was seen in his day in that field.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting when I did the research on my book to find to what extent Franklin was viewed in his own lifetime primarily as a scientist who was also quite good at a number of other things. But that kind of flips the impression of him that we have often had. I think a lot of it has to do with his own autobiography, which was such a popular book in the 19th century, sort of focused a lot on his thrift and industry and sort of Horatio Alger aspect of his life. And so a lot of these other things were sort of marginalized a little bit.
Remind us of his scientific accomplishments, his record there.
Well, he was, of course, he was fascinated by what he called the subtle fluids, things like heat, electricity, water currents, things that had energy but no mass. So he was, for instance, the first person to explain how the Gulf Stream functioned.
Would you would think, with all the sailing that had gone on for all those years, someone might have noticed and explained that before. Of course, electricity gets reduced to his kite and his key, but it was really a major breakthrough in electricity that he brought to the planet, understanding.
That's right. In fact, in his lifetime, Franklin was thought by many other scientists to be an equal of Newton or Galileo, which is amazing to think of, for his work in electricity primarily.
What was the breakthrough in understanding there?
Well, there were a few different things. He was the first person to really kind of explain how electricity worked. He didn't discover it or anything like that, but it had been basically sort of a parlor trick before that. And in the 1740s,
people would make static electricity and watch it pull their hair up, but
exactly,
who knew what it was?
Exactly. And Franklin was the first to really kind of explain how it actually functioned. And then, of course, also his breakthrough proving that the atmosphere itself is electrified, that thunder and lightning were electrical phenomena, was an enormous breakthrough. And that's what initially made him world famous.
Actually. Did he really take the kite and key out on the rainy night and have the electricity zipping down the twine or not?
I believe he did. Yes, I believe he did.
You do?
Oh, yeah.
Why wasn't he blown to smithereens by lightning coming down the kite string?
Well, of course, remember that the kite string wasn't literally struck by lightning. It was more that the atmosphere
was so charged
around what he called a thunder gust was charged. And so he proved that thunder and lightning were electrical, which had never really been shown before. Of course, that was a major, not only a scientific, but also a cultural breakthrough as well.
Edmund Morgan, here's just one example where Ben Franklin's scientific bent took him into the cultural issues, as Philip Dre says, of the time. I mean, I'm reading here that literally, until Franklin came up with this, lightning bolts from the heavens that hit a church steeple or whatever were seen as messages from God. He said, no, this is a natural scientific phenom, and that was a lot for people to swallow.
Well, that wasn't something that everybody believed. I mean, yes, it came from God, but so did the wind and the waves and so on.
Fair enough.
People did not, in general, I believe, think that it was something aimed at a specific person or thing or building.
But the Pat Robertson attitude was out there, and Ben Franklin's breakthrough was a kind of challenge to it.
I think it is a kind of a slander on the people of the 18th century to say that they had a Pat Robertson attitude.
Then we retract it fully. I'm just looking here at reports of unsettled contemporaries of Franklin who felt that all this scientific explanation was, in some dimension, getting in the way of their worldview.
Well, I think it's relatively few who thought that, including relatively few theologians, ministers, whose business was to think about God and what God did to the world.
How did Franklin think about God and religion in general?
He seems to have been a believer in God. He was not an atheist. He did believe that God created the world, and indeed created it all at one blow, so to speak. For he says that just casually at one point that no plant or animal has ever disappeared from the world. He didn't believe it would be possible for species to become extinct because that would mean that God had changed his mind.
And yet he left Boston because he didn't go for religious orthodoxy. Was he Christian? Was he orthodox in his Christianity?
He was a deist. I don't think he believed in the divinity of Christ. Indeed, he said he did not believe in the divinity of Christ. But he did believe in God as the creator of the world.
Did this put him on the outs in those days, or was this typical of founders?
I think it would have been true, perhaps, of Jefferson, Madison, maybe not of John Adams, but it would have been true of, well, no, George Washington was a regular church-going Episcopalian. So Franklin is a little farther out than most of these guys.
Edmund Morgan, begin to take us into the thickets of how Ben Franklin might see the country he helped found all these years on, the political philosophy that he brought to that founding, and how it might match up with what's evolved today.
Well, that's a very pertinent question, because Franklin wrote a little piece when he was in Europe about what America was like. And the main point in that piece was that in America, people do not ask who a man is. They ask what he can do. And he liked to think of America that way. He also was very much concerned about liberty. He expected America to become a great empire, but he was concerned that it be an empire of liberty. And perhaps his most famous epigram was contained in a speech to the governor of Pennsylvania sometime before the Revolution, and one which I think has a very obvious pertinence today. He said, "Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." That's a pretty powerful statement, and one that I think is highly pertinent today when various members of our government are ready to give up essential liberty in order to purchase a little temporary security.
It's been widely quoted in the last few weeks as NSA wiretapping and other extreme measures in the last couple of years have emerged in the response to the terror attacks of 9/11. What about in the face of an attack like that? Do you think Ben Franklin said many things in his long life? Do you think he would have held that view even at the threat that we've seen from terrorism here?
Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I do, because there is nothing to indicate that giving up essential liberty actually produces security. People neither deserve it nor will they get it, in my opinion, and I think in Franklin's.
Philip Dre, he put in the mouth of his character Silence Dogwood, one of the many along with Poor Richard that he created, he had her saying, "I am a mortal enemy to arbitrary government and unlimited power. I am naturally very jealous for the rights and liberties of my country." And right on down that line, "The very least appearance of an encroachment on those invaluable privileges is apt to make my blood boil exceedingly." Here was a guy who was saying, "Don't tread on me," loudly and early.
Well, he was only 16 years old when he wrote that. And, of course, some biographers have kind of linked that to his own treatment at the hands of his older brother, James.
He was an unhappy apprentice under the boot of James.
And James kind of lorded it over him. And here was Silence Dogwood as a 16-year-old writing these lines.
But it seems to have imbued his outlook right through his long life.
Very true. That's very true, yeah.
Edmund Morgan, he was not early to the revolutionary cause. I mean, he lived most of his life under in colonies that were British and imagined they would go on that way.
Indeed, he lived a great deal of his life in England itself. and expected and wanted the empire to continue. But he had a vision of empire that appeared as early as about the 1750s, when he realized that Americans were multiplying at a rate of doubling every 25 years, and that sooner or later a continent would not remain an appendage of an island 30,000 miles away. But he wanted the whole thing to be one, to be a British empire with North American headquarters, probably. And he spent his years in England trying to persuade the ministry who were in charge of making decisions for America that the future of the empire lay there, and there would be not a very good idea to offend the Americans, who were going to outnumber the British in a relatively short span, in perhaps a century.
In the end, of course, it didn't go that way at all, and when he turned to the revolutionary cause, he turned with great fervor, brought France in, crucially, on the American side. Philip Drey, you describe his role in the invention of America itself. What's the heart of that role?
Well, he, of course, his science was something that made him very popular in France. And so this kind of, there was a sort of a, at some point there became kind of a dynamic of Franklin being perceived as both the man who liberated thunder and lightning, but also someone who took the scepter from tyrants, as it was said. And so this kind of gave him a very dynamic posture.
He wore a fur skin cap there, kind
right.
of posed as the rough and ready frontiersman, which he really was not back on the North American continent, and took the French by storm.
Well, it was very interesting, really, in a way, because Franklin really startled the world with his work in electricity. At first, some European scientists thought that he was a made-up person. They couldn't believe America at that time was a place where people obtained snake specimens and flowers and things like that. The idea that this sort of profound scientific work would emerge from a place like Philadelphia was sort of amazing in a way. And so Franklin, yes, he played up that kind of the fact that he, the idea that he was a rustic, he wore a beaver, a fur cap around in Paris. To great effect, actually.
Edmund Morgan, that scientific attitude, how do you see it coming into his understanding of life and the nation? I mean, we read it was he who suggested an edit to Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence that the truths be seen, outlined there, be seen not as sacred but as self-evident, a kind of scientific attitude in itself. Does that run through all of his work? Does it run through our country, his legacy?
I think it is evident in his insatiable curiosity. Everything that he observed made him say, hey, what's going on here? It's an attitude that he applies to every encounter in life. He's fascinated by human beings and wants to know what makes them tick, in the same way that he's fascinated by the weather, by lightning, by anything else. His Poor Richard's Almanac, with all those sayings, contains not just those old saws about industry and thrift, but a lot of shrewd observations about the way human beings behave. Fish and visitors stink in 3 days. No, it's... He's just someone that once you get to know him, you're not sure what to expect, except to expect something new and fresh and unusual in the way he sees things.
And to expect that through that curiosity, he came also with an incredible tolerance, inviting all religions into the American equation, perhaps more earlier and more forthrightly than anybody else, celebrating that right on through the end of his life. We read he was carried in his casket by representatives of every faith in Philadelphia.
Well, he certainly believed, he certainly created, indeed had built, a building where people of any denomination could preach, parsons of any denomination. He was not a member of any church himself. He started out being a member of the Presbyterian Church, but gave up on it pretty quick. He became a great friend of the biggest evangelist of the time, George Whitefield. And George Whitefield did his best to convert him, but Franklin became great friends with him, but laughed away any possibility of his following Whitefield's beliefs.
We're joined now from the City of Brotherly Love, Philadelphia, by Stacy Schiff. She's author of the book, A Great Improvisation, Franklin, France, and the Birth of America. She wrote today in the New York Times an essay entitled Poor Richard's Redemption. Stacy Schiff, thanks very much for being with us.
I'm happy to join you, Tom.
You call him America's, until Tom Sawyer came along, you say. Benjamin Franklin was America's foremost juvenile delinquent. What do you mean?
Well, you know, Franklin put such enormous credit on his running away from home. That's how his autobiography begins. That's the act on which, the first public act of his life, the act on which his life is founded. And there is a sort of uncanny parallel between him slipping the familial chains as a young man and helping America to slip its familial chains, you know, many decades later. He was an insubordinate young man, and I think he always was happy to question authority, which is where part of Franklin's great creativity comes from.
You call him equal parts Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan, and Bugs Bunny. You call him the forgiving founder. What are you telling us there?
Well, you know, one of the reasons, it's an interesting when you want to rack your brains, why do we think of Franklin so much more today? And part of it, I think, is that there's this very human side, this very appealing human side to Franklin. There's nothing austere and off-putting about him. He's not a presumptuous man. And he's, most importantly, he's not a perfect man. And in an age where we talk about other people's lapses and confessions, Franklin's a role model. He's someone who knew he'd done wrong, and proceeded to do everything in his power, or almost everything anyway, to put the apple cart back on its feet. He was a spiteful man, but despite that, he really does his best to try to settle scores properly and to do what's right. But he admits he knows how flawed humankind was. He knew how flawed he was.
Spiteful about what, Stacy?
Oh, he's a good grudge holder. You know, Franklin, as we all know, was a man with a lot of enemies. And these are not enemies he forgets. The beautiful thing about Franklin is that when he writes an angry letter to a political enemy or to a colleague with whom he doesn't get along, he's smart enough not to mail the letter. And that's probably what sets him apart from some of his less temperate colleagues.
A wise man, you say that 100 years ago, on his 200th birthday, he was not celebrated with such affection in this country or honor.
This is something on which other people have written more than I, but Franklin, in an age of spiritual values, doesn't fare as well. He comes off as the mercantile man. He comes off as a man, the sort of shallow shopkeeper of the early colonial figures. He's far too earthy in a way, if you're thinking about romantic values. Or
far too earthy for what, the end of the 19th century?
End of the 19th century. I mean, the great attack on Franklin is D.H. Lawrence's in the 1920s, but even before then, he doesn't fare well in the annals of history.
What did D.H. Lawrence say?
Oh, D.H. Lawrence has a diatribe against Franklin, which is almost worth reading, just to learn more about Lawrence. But he thinks Franklin is a vile, shabby man. The snuff-colored Franklin, he wishes he could drum out his very existence.
So why a vile, shabby man in such a resurgence of respect in 2006?
Well, I think he is, in a way, as I've just said, a man who came a great distance and overcame what many consider to be, some of the psychological drawbacks, some of his personality flaws. But also, he's a doer. Franklin's a very, very efficiency-minded, economy-minded man who likes to get things done. And that is not always, in all cultures, in all times, that is not always a valued commodity.
Martin is calling from Fairfax, South Carolina. Hi, Martin. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You know, one of the big stories of late is the Abramoff scandal and the fact that politicians sometimes use their positions for financial gain. Your historians can speak to this. I heard that our postal service was created by Ben Franklin because he wanted a means to sell and distribute his own publications. So maybe the mixing of government and money have been with us since the beginning of the Republic.
Let us pick it up. Stacy Schiff, what do you make of that?
Well, I would say that's reversing the equation a little bit. Certainly, Franklin knew the Postal Service was a great way to sell his product. He's a very good nepotist. I mean, more members of the Franklin family served in the Postal Service than any of us could count. On the other hand, Franklin is the one who suggests that public servants serve without salary for the very reason of which we are now so aware. Of course, that would have limited the people who could serve in government to a rather small class of people.
And opened the others to bribery or blandishments.
Exactly.
Let's take another call. Daniel's calling. Daniel's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Just two short questions. How did Franklin invent social institutions like lending libraries and fire departments without holding political office? In other words, where did his power come from as a citizen? And also, on a different note, as a citizen, what would he think of an America today where the people have essentially become avid consumers instead of responsible citizens?
Let us pick them both up. Edmund Morgan, what about it? He had all these amazing ideas, lending libraries and fire companies and police forces, hospital, insurance companies. Daniel says, well, how did he make those real when he wasn't an office holder?
Well, he was very shrewd about it. He had a club of young men that he formed where they used to discuss social questions, political questions, and he would frequently launch an idea there. Then he would write what would today be called an editorial in his newspaper. It would be a letter to the editor, because that's the only way public personal opinions got into newspapers. Mm-hmm. And he would always attribute it to somebody else. He was very shrewd about not promoting himself through these things. He would give it as the idea of a group of merchants or a group of citizens that might be a good idea, and let it catch on until there were enough people interested in it to form a subscription for a library, for a hospital, for public lighting, for paving the streets, and so on. It was always a matter of tactics with him to get somebody else to take credit for it.
Philip Dre, that suggests an America so open to innovation that a thinker like Franklin could float the idea up there, and the next thing you knew, it was happening.
Well, of course, another aspect, too, is he was obviously an extremely charming man, Franklin, very good at bringing people of diverse views together and unifying them. And, of course, in all these things, whether it was a hospital, police, fire force, or whatever, he also was someone who led by example very much. When Philadelphia was threatened by pirates in the 1740s, Franklin not only raised money to buy some cannon from from New York, but actually went there himself to help bring the cannon back to Philadelphia. So he was someone who was willing to kind of show the way, but also kind of bring everyone else in as well.
And Stacy Schiff, when he went to France, I guess with the mission to bring them in on the side of the American revolutionaries, what did he offer France that brought them to that position? Was it the pragmatic Franklin? Was it the idealistic Franklin? What was his siren song to the French?
You asked the right question. He plays both angles. He's very smart about appealing to the French, not for practical reasons, which is what his colleagues would have done, not in terms of you will have America's trade if you come to save our country, but he put the whole equation in terms of glory. You will have the glory of having created this new country. You will have the glory of having saved this poor, oppressed people. And as Professor Morgan points out, he, in the end, made that whole project seem as if it were American independence were somehow the brainstorm of Louis XVI. I mean, he really turned the tables around and made it seem as if this whole idea was a fabulous French fantasy, and the French should be overjoyed at watching themselves make it happen.
Put that in a current context for us. I guess it couldn't be hard power that Franklin really wielded in those days, so it was soft power. It was the attraction of association with young America.
There was a real French fantasy at that point about what this new world represented, and the French government was very much under the influence of a liberal group of aristocrats who really were banking on this great experiment in democracy. But remember, too, that America didn't represent any kind of power at that point. It was, in geopolitical terms, like the island of Corsica. There was no sense that this was ever going to be a true nation to rival France or England in any way. It was more just this intellectual experiment, really, that the French were banking on.
We can't ignore the romantic side of this man's life. He was very alive to life, to the world, and to women, Stacey Schiff, not least in France.
No, and his French letters to his two, I guess you'd call them paramours, although I'm not sure how much beyond the letters the relationships really went, are amazingly, wonderfully flirtatious documents. There was a younger woman in the neighborhood with whom he hoped to have a physical relationship with, and an older woman a little further down the street whom he hoped to make the second Mrs. Franklin, in fact.
A womanizer, a dreamer, a romantic letter writer, what in the end?
I think probably a very successful flirt, alas.
That's not too bad. Philip Dre, on the scientific front, he was a son of the Enlightenment, maybe, one of the foremost figures of the Enlightenment. How do you think he would feel in our current more constrained attitude towards science or questioning attitude?
I can't help but think he'd be a little concerned today. I think he might be surprised to find that we're still debating the difference between faith and science, for one thing. I think he'd be disappointed to find that there are people in our government who will allow political, economic, and religious influences to supersede scientific truth, for instance. Something like climate change, I think of Franklin all the time because that's a scientific subject that he would have loved. He loved large natural systems, trying to understand them. And the fact that this indeed seems to be a threat, it's again the kind of thing Franklin might have helped us out on, because he was so good at getting people to work together of diverse view. And obviously a situation like this is a climate change is a current scientific situation where there's really a lack of any consensus.
Philip Dre, author of Stealing God's Thunder, wonderful to have you with us in this conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. And Edmund Morgan, biographer, author of Benjamin Franklin, professor of emeritus of history at Yale. Professor Morgan, thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
And Stacey Schiff in Philadelphia, where they're celebrating today, author of the new book, A Great Improvisation, Franklin, France, and the Birth of America. Stacey Schiff, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. I'm going to go light some more candles.
All right, you do it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.